Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. In a time when the political climate is anything but pastoral, sometimes what we need is a chance to retreat to the countryside for a relaxing dose of drama, an illicit love affair, and a violent murder. Fortunately, all of these are fictional.
They play out in a rural Midwestern setting in Minnesota writer Mindy Mejia's new murder mystery, Everything You Want Me to Be. Mejia was in Milwaukee yesterday for a reading at Boswell Book Company, and she joined us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me today.
So let's get a couple of things out of the way first. This is a murder mystery, and so we will stop short of giving away too many plot points.
Yes.
But there are a few basics that we learned pretty early on. What are we comfortable talking about here?
Yeah, well, the basic premise is that on the opening night of her high school play, Hattie Hoffman is found stabbed to death near her home in an abandoned barn in rural southern Minnesota. Sheriff Del Goodman is assigned to investigate her murder, and he vows to find her killer. But what he discovers instead is that Hattie's acting talents ran far beyond the stage, and the facade of her perfect life hid secrets that could tear apart her small town community.
Right. And small towns, you know, I wonder if it was really necessary to set this in a small town, because small towns are such that we tend to think we know everyone.
Right, exactly. And that's the idea, that it is a close-knit community. And, you know, despite the kind of independence and resilience that a lot of those people have, they do know each other, and they pride themselves on having that close-knit community and that sense of belonging.
Well, and so Hattie is really the character that everything revolves around. How did you get to know Hattie? I mean, teenagers are tough enough to figure out, but she is really challenging.
Right. And the myth that I started this book with was that I could easily write a teenage character because I had been a teenage girl, right? But that was actually a while ago. and you forget. So luckily, I had saved all of my old high school journals. And so I went back and reread those just to kind of get back into the mindset of a teenager. And that was hugely helpful.
Can we say a little bit about who some of the other characters are? Because there's a pretty key plot point that happens pretty early in the book, and I won't mention it if you don't want me to, but she's definitely drawn to one of her teachers.
Exactly, yes. There's three point of view characters in the book, so Hattie, of course, is one of them. We hear her story in the 6 months leading up to her death. Del Goodman, the sheriff, is the other point of view character that's investigating her murder, and then the third point of view character is Peter Lund, who's the new English teacher in town. He's directing the play that Hattie stars in on the night of her death, and she is drawn to him. Hattie is someone who's always felt displaced in her community. She always had her sights set on what she thought of was bigger. You know, she wanted to go to New York. And Peter, having come from the Twin Cities, not a huge town, but
a lot bigger than Pine Valley.
A lot bigger than Pine Valley. So she's naturally drawn to him.
Well, right. And so, I mean, you set the book in rural southern Minnesota, where Rochester is the big city, and I put that in quotation marks.
Yeah.
It could easily be set in rural Wisconsin, and Appleton could be the big city, or mm-hmm. Green Bay or whatever. But I guess the question is here, I wonder if one of the underrated elements to this book is the urban-rural divide.
That is something that I wanted to explore. The book was inspired, I mean, Pine Valley is a fictional town, but it was inspired by the towns where my grandparents farmed their entire lives, which was in southern Minnesota, south of Rochester. And I wanted to write a book about that type of community. But also, as I was growing up, I grew up in the Twin Cities in a small town that's kind of become a suburb over the years because of urban sprawl. But it was very much a small town when I lived there. And when I was growing up, I always had that, you know, sense that I needed to go somewhere bigger as well. You know, that I, you know, something about the urban area was going to be better for me. And that wasn't the case at all, you know, as I grew up. And now I live in the town next door to the town where I was raised. But I think there is that idea when you're growing up, you know, to try to go and be part of something, you know, bigger, maybe have more culture. And, you know, there's that myth of going in that direction. That was phrased really badly.
That's all right. I mean, it's not too dissimilar from the grass is always greener cliche.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And I mean, there is a cultural divide, you know, between rural communities and urban communities that, you know, we don't always like to pay attention to, but it became pretty apparent in this last election.
Tell us a little bit more about Del. Del is the sheriff that is, I was going to say assigned, but he really kind of takes this case on because, you know, it's a small town. But he's a more interesting character than we might initially imagine.
Yeah, he's a Vietnam veteran, and so he's no stranger to bodies, murder. You know, he's seen it before, but he has been drawn to Pine Valley and considers that his home now because of its apparent safety and the fact that you don't have a lot of the murder rates, you know, more of the violence that you see in the larger urban areas. And so apart from knowing the victim and feeling that she was sort of his daughter, you know, the closest thing that he had to a daughter, he's also disturbed by the fact that this is happening in his town and is trying to get to the bottom of that. Personally, he was one of my favorite characters to write because he had the voice, not the personality or the motives, but the voice and the diction of my maternal grandfather.
What did you glean from your own high school journals, you know, and how in touch were you still with the things that you had been thinking in those days and writing about?
It was like reading someone else's journals. I mean, you're so far removed from that sensibility as you move on with your life and mature that it was kind of interesting to go back to that. What I gleaned the most was that there is this inherent narcissism in those years, you know, as you're really trying to figure out your identity and who you are. The boundaries of your world are expanding so rapidly and you're trying to figure out your place in it. And that was probably the closest I was going to be able to come to identify with Hattie because she's a very different person. She is a natural actress, a people pleaser in appearance, but she doesn't take on those roles altruistically. You know, she does it because she can.
Right. And one of the things that really kind of jumped out, I mean, I was thinking about my own teen years, which are, you know, fairly far in the past. But, you know, I remember going through high school and thinking, you know, this could be a movie. This could be a sitcom. This could be a TV show. And never being entirely sure about whether I was the star or a supporting character in it. But Hattie is absolutely sure she is front and center.
Yes. That's something that she knows. You know, she's more sure of that than almost anything else.
Well, and you, it looked like that was coming out in you as well. I mean, I wonder if that's a universal. We all sort of see ourselves in an acting role at that age.
I think there is a bit of that. I was never the actress that Hattie was. I was always happier with my nose in a book. So that's really where I spent my high school years and just trying to get out of high school. But
there's a lot of literature that comes out in this book.
There is. Yeah. Some of my favorite books appear here. We get to canvas Jane Eyre, V by Thomas Pynchon, and of course, Macbeth, which is the play that she's starring in that night.
Are we allowed to say that out loud?
We're not in the playhouse right now, so it's okay. But yes, there is a curse of Macbeth, which is triggered by saying the name of the play in the playhouse where it's being performed.
And, you know, and Macbeth, there is a lot in Macbeth that is a good metaphor for what kind of plays out in this book.
Right. I mean, Macbeth was one of the most intense psychological studies that Shakespeare made. It was one of his four great tragedies. And it's interesting because Macbeth was not a man, you know, like Othello. You know, he wasn't evil. He wasn't suicidal like Hamlet. He wasn't blinded or stupid. You know, he was an ordinary man, you know, like you or I, who was tempted, understood the cost, and succumbed anyway.
The book jumps around in time, you know, pre-murder and post-murder, what, 6 months leading up to the murder and in the days following the murder. How did you piece it together for yourself? Where did the story actually start for you?
The story started for me pretty much where we start in the book, which, apart from a quick prologue, we are in the barn with Dell seeing this body. And so that's how it first came to me, was the image of this abandoned, decrepit barn with a body inside.
Well, and did you know who did it from the get-go?
I did not. It was about four chapters from the end of the first draft where I figured it out. And I think in retrospect, that might have helped, you know, because I wasn't writing in that direction. And so hopefully, since it surprised me, it might surprise a reader.
Do you have to go back and kind of retrofit everything that you have written to that point to make sure it lines? I mean, obviously you do.
Yes. Yeah. There's definitely some revision involved in that then when you understand who your murderer is and just setting that up so that when you get to the end, you have that surprising yet inevitable feeling where you can kind of pull on those threads that you've been building.
Right. I mean, there has to be an art to making it a surprise while at the same time making it believable.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we've all read those books that just have the crazy twist at the end. And you're like, well, where did that come from? You know, and it's not quite as satisfying as seeing things come together and stack up in the direction that they were building.
Hattie is, and I think we can use this without giving anything away, a fairly manipulative person.
She is.
At the same time, do you feel for her as the author creating her and setting her into motion?
I did. I did have a lot of sympathy for Hattie. I think she is a manipulator, but at the same time, she manipulates herself and convinces herself of things as she's doing them. And so she's as much a victim of her manipulations as she is the perpetrator.
And when you're a high schooler, things can easily spiral out of control especially in your own mind.
Exactly. You can set things in motion without really understanding the full consequences of your actions. And obviously that's what's happening here.
What did you feel for Peter?
I was sympathetic to Peter as well. I was probably less sympathetic to him than the other two characters, but I did have sympathy for Peter. He got into a situation where he married young and he wasn't really prepared to move out into this rural area where his wife was from in order to care for her dying mother. That's not really what he signed up for, and he didn't have the maturity to evolve with that as the situation demanded.
And he always saw himself as this kind of big city person who had ended up in a small town.
He did. He was very much this burgeoning hipster, you know, in 2007 and identified with the urban areas where he was from.
2007 is not that long ago in the grand scheme of things, mm-hmm. but it is 10 years ago. Was there a certain amount of work you had to do to make sure that that the stuff that was happening in 2007 was really happening in 2007?
I did some fact checking, yes. And there are certain parts of the book that it felt critical to move us back to that because that was really before. I mean, you think only 10 years ago, but smartphones weren't as highly used then. You know, there was
right,
a little
Facebook
bit,
doesn't really show up.
And there was no real social media, you know, that's kind of commonplace now that you just take for granted. So even going only back 10 years, there are some significant differences in how we related to each other.
You wrote this book even as you're pursuing your other career in the accounting world. when do you find time to write? And is this book brewing in the back of your mind while you're keeping track of numbers?
Yes, don't tell my boss.
Boss has to know at some level.
Yeah. I primarily write on my lunch breaks at work. That's my main writing time because when I get home, I have young children. And so that's the best time that I have to really check out and go into these worlds that I'm creating. So I write during lunch, but I'll try to think about the scene that I'm working on that day as I'm commuting into work. And, you know, it's always kind of boiling in the back of my head to make those connections. And so sometimes in meetings, I do end up straying into the book a little bit.
Well, it has to be a little bit surreal to be sitting there and crunching numbers or going from that to lunch and having to write these gory details and then go back to the button-down world of accounting.
Yeah, exactly. You know, sometimes people will come in during my lunch break and I'm writing and they're asking me this accounting question and I'm like, I'm trying to stab someone to death right now. Can you wait? You know, the car chase is almost done. Just hang on a second. We'll get to you.
So have your coworkers read this? Do they know about this side of you?
Yes. Now that the book has come out, some of them have read it, have been out to some of the events that we've had in the Twin Cities for the book tour. And it's been really interesting to see how these different areas of my life mesh up.
Well, Mindy Mejia, it's a page turner in the best sense of the word. Thank you so much.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me.
Young teacher, the subject of schoolgirl fantasy. She wants him so badly, knows what she wants to be.
Mindy Mejia's latest mystery novel is called Everything You Want Me to Be. Mejia, who lives in the Twin Cities, was in Milwaukee this week for a reading at Boswell Book Company.